Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading this in-depth interview podcast. Today, former NSA Technical Director Bill Binney returns, joined by former CIA analyst Larry C. Johnson, with additional evidence about why the DNC was not hacked by the Russians. And we're going to talk about some issues that we're not supposed to touch. Bill Binney has actual evidence to support his claim that the DNC material that was taken was captured in a copy, an insider leak, not an outsider hack. And we get into some of the topics we're not supposed to talk about, including the role, the possible role of Seth Rich, the DNC staffer who met an untimely murder on the streets of Washington, D.C., Imran Awan, who was the technical guru for the head of the DNC at the time, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and we also speculate about a possible role for Israeli intelligence in creating the Russiagate cover story. I think you'll find this fascinating, assuming that you're not completely captured by the Rachel Maddow telenovela. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you who subscribe. People like Terry Paris, Don Cisney, and Paul Lacombe. They each kick in $5 or $10 a month. You can do it too. Just visit peterbcollins.com. Today on the Peter B. Collins podcast, Bill Binney returns, joined by Larry Johnson, to discuss why the DNC was not hacked by the Russians.
To respond to all the threats and the rhetorical speeches of the Soviets. Mr. Khrushchev said he will bury you. I don't subscribe to this point of view. It would be such an ignorant thing to do if the Russians love their children too.
Sting's tune from the 80s is still relevant today, as America and to some extent Europe are gripped in hysteria of the Russiagate scandal. And just one notion about this showed up in a recent poll. 55% of Democrats believe that Robert Mueller has proved that there was collusion between Trump and Russians, including the Russian government. And this is something that Mueller has not even alleged in the string of indictments and a few convictions that have surfaced so far. All along, I have relied on the counsel of Bill Binney, former technical director at the National Security Agency, and last week with Larry C. Johnson, who served in the CIA and later at the State Department. He's been running a private security company since then. They penned a piece that was released under the headline that I just read, Why the DNC Was Not Hacked by the Russians. Bill, welcome back. Larry C. Johnson, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Good to meet you, Peter.
Thanks for having me back.
You bet, Bill. And just by way of introduction, Larry, you have been no stranger to controversy. You are very willing to criticize the agencies you used to work for, our government and our political figures, and I deeply respect that. Recently, you were smeared because, based on some of your sources, you allege that Trump Tower was, in fact, wiretapped, despite the denials by the Obama administration in 2016, and that you allege it was wiretapped by our pals in Britain at GCHQ, the equivalent of the NSA. Now, this is something that I find highly credible, and we know that the Five Eyes agencies were doing work for each other that wouldn't have been possible under the laws of the specific host nation. So, for example, the Obama administration can say we didn't wiretap Trump Tower, and the fact that allied groups did is kind of pushed into the background. So talk a little bit about that, please.
Sure. Well, actually, what I corrected, when Trump came out and said he was wiretapped, I was actually interviewed on RT, Russia Today, and I noted that Trump misused the term wiretap. His communications were being intercepted, but those intercepts were being done by the Brits, principally GCHQ. It was fascinating that when I said that on RT, nobody reacted to it at all. About 3 days later, one of our Bill and my former colleagues passed information to Judge Andrew Napolitano at Fox News. Judge Napolitano went in and he talked about what I had written up for the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity on our bulletin board, but he got some of it wrong, and the Brits went crazy. They brought pressure to bear on Fox. It looked like Napolitano was going to get fired. He was sent home, and the judge, I didn't know him before this. I mean, we never had any personal relationship or contact, calls me up and says, "Would I agree to talk to the New York Times reporter about why he said what he said based upon what I had written?" I stupidly agreed to do that, and then the New York Times reporter completely misrepresented what I said, and man, I was in the center of this firestorm. What was fascinating, though, was 2 weeks after this, following all this blow-up, the Guardian newspaper, not exactly a bastion of right-wing conservative thinking, came out and acknowledged that, in fact, the Brits and others, the Australians and the Belgians, had been collecting on Trump since 2015. So they confirmed what I was saying. It was just, you know, the phrase, people always try to trip you up and say, "Well, you said wiretap." And I said, "Well, no, I didn't say wiretap." So that was a sort of a new introduction. I've been in some controversies before this, but nothing like this.
Well, and one of the attacks on you was that you appeared on RT. And because, you know, no other corporate media outlet will entertain things that run counter to the official Russiagate narrative, there are many people who've taken their views onto RT because they've been invited.
Well, yeah, actually, one of the real ironies of this is I was interviewed during this controversy by Brian Stelter on CNN. And he brought up that very point. Well, how dare you appear on RT? And I said, "Well, Brian, the fundamental difference between RT and CNN," I said, "you guys always do pre-interviews. You make sure you know what I'm going to say, and if you don't agree with it, you don't put me on air." I said, "I've run into that with BBC, MSNBC, every one of the major networks." I said, "The only television network that I've been on that does not do pre-interviews to find out what I'm going to say is RT."
Well,
that sort of shut him up.
And, you know, I'm not a big fan of Fox News, but that doesn't mean that Fox News doesn't report accurately at times.
You know, like a broken clock, it's right twice a day.
Maybe. Okay. So, Bill, what we call the Binney theorem, related to how the material was removed from DNC servers that wound up in circulation via WikiLeaks, how did that occur? And this goes back, of course, to 2015 and 2016. And you have previously shared with us the Binney theorem, that this was not a hack, but an insider leak, most likely managed by using a thumb drive or a small portable hard drive. And you and Larry have added to the theorem in this latest report. Could you please thumbnail for new listeners the original Binney theorem, and then we will add the new forensic evidence that you're citing in the latest document?
Okay, well, the original theorem came out of the Guccifer II material. That was where download rate, which we could calculate from the material that Guccifer, see, that's the big mistake that Guccifer II made. And that all these people behind Guccifer II, whoever they are, this is a big mistake they made. They thought they could put material out there to try to justify the statements they were making, but what they didn't realize was when they put that material out there, that's gold to manage to analyze and figure out what's really happening. So that was their big error, okay? Mm-hmm. And the same is true with the allegations from Mueller when he didn't look at the damn data from the DNC, which is what we're talking about now in terms of the FAT format. But the previous stuff was that the data was downloaded so fast that it couldn't go across the network. And we tried it, and others said, oh, yeah, it could, and so on. I said, well, we can't get it there. If you know how to do it, please show us, and we'll even help you to try to do it. And nobody came forward to do any of that. They all just backed away. So, I mean, you know, they were left what I was basically addressing was the factless base that everybody was using to make their conclusions about Russiagate. I mean, they were all based on hot air and emotion and just a general reaction of people to Donald Trump as president. So, I mean, this is just crazy. So, I mean, we were losing total objectivity and and just operating on totally on emotion. So that was the Guccifer II stuff, and now I got called a general theory, it was just generated by theory, and there was nothing, but in fact, I had fact behind it, and everything that everybody else was saying, including Mueller and Rosenstein, had no facts behind anything they were saying. And so, you know, when it came now looking at the DNC material, now this is really the stuff that gets down to what they were claiming was taken by the Russians and given to WikiLeaks. Well, we started looking at the WikiLeaks data that was put out there. Some of our friends and co-analysts in Europe were doing that. And as they did that, they came across this the modified times on the files, which every time you do something to a file, it will put, here's the last modified time.
Well, let's be a little more detailed about that when you say do something to a file. When you transfer it and it goes through the system, logs are kept, and it yes. clocks the time it left, and it clocks the time it arrived at its new destination, right?
That's correct. That's true, too. But this is modifying the times in the files as last modified file. Like if you go in and change something, it will change the last modified time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, and FAT file format does that. So and not all things do that when you copy it, so it's just this particular form of, but this is the most popular file format used to download to thumb drives and other storage devices.
Peter, let me just jump in here, because I've been trying to come up with proper, you know,
yeah.
analogies, metaphors, so the average person sitting out there can understand it. Maybe, so when you think about FAT, that is a type of computer architecture, just like we have colonial architecture, contemporary architecture, ranch style. And so let's think of FAT like colonial, because every time you see a FAT structure, that means it was copied. It was taken. You go from the original source, and to move the data from the original source, the information, and put it someplace else, the only way you can do that is you have to copy it onto another hard drive or a CD-ROM or a thumb drive, some physical medium. You have mm-hmm. to do a physical transfer. It's nothing that you can do through the air, through wireless, or through the Internet.
Okay.
And so that's what, when Bill's getting to that, because he understands this stuff intuitively, but, you know, some of us dummies out there are, you know, grasping, trying to figure out What do it mean?
Yeah.
And you see, that's why I'm depending on people like Larry to be able to translate for me. You know?
Well, and I close caption these things to help me, okay?
Yeah. Okay, all right.
So, Bill, one of the features or things that we know about FAT files, and FAT stands for file allocation table, is that it always ends the file in an even number.
Yeah, it modifies the last modified time to an even number, to the nearest even number.
Okay.
So we were looking at the 500 files out of the DNC, two batches of the DNC, or three batches, really, of the DNC material, and that had the FAT format because all the times modified ended in an even number.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know me, I'm a mathematician, okay? So I have to calculate the random probability of that occurring just randomly. Okay, well, anything could end in an even number or an odd, so the chance of it always being even is 1 in 2. 1 chance in 2, right?
Okay. I got that far. Yeah.
So 500 of them in a row, all being even, the chance of all of them being even randomly is 1 chance in 2 to the 500th power, which is roughly the equivalent of 10 to the 150 power. And for people who like to look at numbers, that's a 1 followed by 150 zeros.
That's like me winning the Powerball.
Actually, it's even worse than that.
Okay.
You got a better shot at the Powerball.
Okay. Yeah, that's right.
All right, that puts it in perspective that I can understand, guys.
Okay.
Now, in addition to this information, you list the three transfers from the DNC servers. The first occurred on May 23rd of 2016 at 2:12:38 a.m., and the transfer period lasted a little bit over half an hour, and it ended at 02:45:42. The next transfer was at a pre-dawn hour. This was on the 25th of May at 5:21:30 a.m., and that was a session that lasted about 40 minutes, ending at 6:04:36. And the final one was on August 26th. Now, that date we want to hold in our minds because many things had occurred before then. And this was a transfer at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 14:11:36. And that one went on for a while, about 6 hours, concluding at 20:06:04. So just baseline, what does this metadata tell us, Bill?
Well, it basically says that the data was being transferred after it was downloaded to a thumb drive because the rates coming out are compatible with a transfer across the net.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it could have been transferred anywhere after it was downloaded. It could have been transferred from any point. You can move it anywhere and then transfer it from that point to wherever you want to put it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that... is unclear as to where that happened. Now, I maintain NSA should know exactly where that happened.
And you were the technical director of the NSA before you resigned in protest, and you argue that Ed Snowden confirms what you had speculated, and that is that the NSA has essentially wired every node in the world, and they can tell what traffic is passing through there.
That's correct. And, you know, that gets back to what was said to Judge Napolitano about the British looking at all this data about, you know, Trump Tower and now President Trump, even before the election. I mean, the point was that NSA has got all this stuff set up after 9/11. They basically have about 80 to 100 tap points inside the United States where they collect and sessionize and report all Internet traffic, and they have a view into all public switch telephone network communications. So that's like 3 billion phone calls a day just within the U.S. and, you know, maybe another billion, close to a billion emails and spam type stuff that goes on within the United States. So that all of that, they have the view into it, and they have the ability to take it and collect and keep it all. Now, I'm sure they filter some of it out, like, you know, the standard television transmissions. You don't want to put those in files. That's just wasting storage. So they would probably eliminate those and maybe a few other things. But when it comes to the fundamental things of when people communicate with people, they store basically all of that.
And Bill, my insight into that came from a heroic man named Mark Klein, who was an AT&T technician here in San Francisco. And he went public talking about, I believe his book was subtitled, Wiring Up the Big Brother Machine. And at the switch site here in San Francisco on Folsom Street, he discovered that there was a secret room being constructed. He kept a list of the equipment, the gear that was delivered to that room, and he was able to figure out that they had put a huge diverter, a switching system, so that all the traffic coming through this centralized switch in San Francisco was diverted in a carbon copy, if you will, to the NSA.
Yeah, that's right. It was a Y splitter they put into the network to be able to that basically duplicates both lines, or takes one line and splits it into two parts, two equal parts, and one part went to the NSA room, the other part went to the standard distribution of communications. So,
Now,
they got paid for doing that too, by the way.
Yes, they did.
The government paid them for that.
Larry Johnson, you worked at the CIA in the 80s, State Department intelligence into the early 90s, and you've been in the private security arena since then. What's your comment on this forensic information that we're discussing?
Well, the forensic information helps make sense of the other information we know is in the public realm and has been admitted and acknowledged to by some of the people that claim that they were the discoverers of what was going on. And I refer specifically to the articles that have appeared about the CrowdStrike and its owner, Alperovich, and the fact that he has told reporters, multiple reporters, on the record publicly, that they first learned that the Democrats thought there had been an intrusion on May 5th. Now, the Democrats apparently felt that there was something that had happened as early as April 28th or 29th. So here you've got the cybersecurity company. They've been told the equivalent, somebody's breaking into your house. So what do? Well, they open up, they send their personnel there. Now, anybody that has any basic understanding of this kind of attack would know the first thing you do is you disconnect the network. What did CrowdStrike do? They did not disconnect the network. They left it up and running. Then they installed some software, they subsequently report, that would, quote, monitor everybody's activities. So they're monitoring everybody who's doing anything on the computer network at the DNC. Now, the other thing that none of the media reports on is the fact, who was the network administrator for the DNC computer? Well, it turns out it's a guy named Imran Awan, a Pakistani who worked for Debbie Wasserman Schultz. But most importantly, he gives all the hallmarks of an intelligence operative, somebody who was working for Pakistani intelligence. It just, he's got the complete sort of the look, the feel, and the activity of it.
He had the means and the opportunity because he was the technical advisor to Wasserman Schultz, and she kept a separate laptop where she managed all of her DNC activities, part of that to keep the separation from her day job as a member of Congress. And he had access to that device and to the networks that it was enabled to engage with.
Right.
And so I agree with you. I think he is a primary suspect, and we've seen no indication that Robert Mueller, the special counsel's investigators, have made any effort to depose him, to investigate what he may or may not have done. And he's on my list here, Larry, of the unpursued leads of St. Bob Mueller.
Yeah, it absolutely has to be there. So now as we follow the timeline, we know, given this latest batch of, you know, Bill's latest findings with respect to, we got at least two data points showing that there was a physical download onto something that likely a thumb drive, but it could have been another hard drive, but it was a physical medium. That took place on May 23rd and May 24th. That's relevant because when you look at the emails that are posted at WikiLeaks, the last one that's posted is dated the morning of May 25th. That's the time frame we're looking at. So now let's come back to CrowdStrike. What do they do? Well, they don't do anything until June 10th. And this is in an article that appeared, I believe it was in Esquire magazine. And they report that on June 10th, they finally disconnected all the computers from the network and installed new security software. Well, the horse had already left the barn. That was more than 2 weeks previously. So when you put the forensic evidence side by side with what is the publicly acknowledged timeline by CrowdStrike itself, it doesn't make sense. Now, a couple other things to factor in. I think there is a reliable source. I know of two sources. One is Ellen Ratner. She was a former commentator on the news. And then her sister, Margaret Ratner Nussler, or her sister-in-law.
I know Ellen.
Yeah, so Margaret was the wife of Michael Ratner, Ellen's brother.
Mm-hmm.
And Margaret was the attorney, and Michael, they had an attorney-client relationship with Julian Assange.
And Margaret, her family name was Kunstler.
Kunstler, right.
From the William Kunstler, a famous lawyer. And I knew Michael Ratner, who passed away a few years ago. He was the founder and, I think, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And they've done a lot of incredible but also controversial work confronting our government's excesses.
And so you've got both of them attributing this removal of the DNC emails from and passing them to WikiLeaks to Seth Rich. Now, what's the relevance of this?
Excuse me, Larry, we're not allowed to mention Seth Rich. The family has asked us not to talk about Seth, okay?
Well, without mentioning the person's name,
Larry,
there are...
Larry, I'm being facetious.
Okay.
I am offended at the idea that we're not allowed to ask questions about what happened to Seth Rich, about his contacts with WikiLeaks, about you know, the circumstances of his murder. And this is not a closed case by any means. And yet anyone who raises questions about it in an honest search for the truth is immediately attacked, and we attempt to silence them.
Yeah, and I think part of the problem there is the, you know, I know Fox News got into some trouble originally because they tried to link the murder of Seth to the removal of the emails from the DNC. I don't do that. I'm simply, I want to stick, let's just stick with the facts. And the facts we know is that Seth worked at the DNC. The emails were downloaded by somebody. There are other witnesses, credible witnesses, that have direct access to Julian Assange. And according to Julian, it was Seth Rich. We also have Julian Assange going in public, offering a reward for the killer of Seth Rich, which, with all the WikiLeaks information that they get every year, I don't recall them ever offering a reward for anybody at any time over the year. So that to me, suggests that there may be a relationship there. Whether Seth's death had anything to do with the DNC emails, I don't know. But it is worth noting this point. Once the emails are downloaded on the 25th, and the allegation is that Seth engaged in negotiations with WikiLeaks, those negotiations were carried out via either email or telephone or text message, some form of electronic communication. Well, guess what? There are both the NSA and GCHQ are collecting every bit of information coming into WikiLeaks. And there's an attorney by the name of Ty Clevenger. He submitted a FOIA request to NSA and got back an answer. They admitted that they have conversations between Seth Rich and Julian Assange, but those are top secret and cannot be released. So when you put all that together, what this tells me is that the intelligence community became aware that there was these DNC emails floating out there, and I personally believe, this is speculation, this is not based upon evidence, but I personally believe that it was at that juncture that they created this lie that it was the Russians, that they were going to blame this on the Russians, and because what you see is an orchestrated media rollout. You get the piece in the Washington Post on the 14th of June by Ellen Nakashima, and then the next day, you have this character, Guccifer 2.0, would show up and claim, oh, it's not the Russians, it's me. But everything in his metadata has everything but the sign saying, I love Joseph Stalin and I am Russian. it was deliberately designed to make it look like it was Russian,
right?
And shift the entire direction away. Now, why this was done, I don't know. That would get into other speculation. But I think once you look at the timeline with the forensic evidence that Bill has, studiously come up with, it just shows that the story that's being fed to the American public about Russian hack is just a bunch of crap.
And gentlemen, we're speaking here in the roughly the middle of February, and most recently, Robert Mueller has issued indictments against Roger Stone. I've read those indictments, and they are mostly about lying about bullshitting. Stone is a profligate bullshitter.
Yes.
And, he kind of modified some of his bullshit along the way. And that's what, so far, he has been accused of. And as we're speaking, he has compounded his problems with an Instagram post with a picture of the judge and some angry language about her. And that is not going to help him in any way. But, I have never, had any support or fascination with Roger Stone. But I still have to make the case that to date, he has not been directly implicated in the critical link that is missing public evidence, and that is the alleged transfer from Russian hackers to WikiLeaks of the purloined data from the DNC servers. And since you've established that it wasn't hacked by Russians or anybody else, then we are still looking for the link of how that material got to WikiLeaks and how Robert Mueller's investigation has looked at that. So, Bill Binney, what is the state of play on this critical link, WikiLeaks acquiring the DNC information?
That's, as far as I know, is still the big gap. The only information we have is that that may relate is Ambassador Craig Murray had said that he had met on the campus of American University in Washington, D.C. He met with somebody who was involved in the transfer of data to WikiLeaks. Now, that would imply physical transfer again.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that would be consistent with why NSA has said nothing. Also, why they only had moderate confidence in the ICA that the supposedly intelligence community was only really three and selected analysts from three, CIA, NSA, and FBI. FBI and CIA had high confidence that the Russians did it, and NSA only had moderate.
And well, and you explain what that means in human parlance.
Well, I mean they even discredit their assessment in their same paper on page 13. They say by high confidence that does not necessarily mean we have proof that makes something an absolute certainty or absolutely true. So it's just a wind. It's hot air from them. That's all. But the important one and the only one that was important here was NSA. And they only had moderate. Now, if they had the data to show the transfer, there wouldn't be moderate anything. It would be here is who did it, and there's where it went.
Yeah, let me jump in on that point as a former analyst. When I would write for the Presidential Daily Brief or what at the time was called the National Intelligence Daily, you always had to source. If you had something that came from the CIA's human source reporting, you'd say, according to a reliable source or according to a source with knowledge that had access, making clear that it was a human source. Or if it was from an intercept like NSA did, you'd say, according to signal intelligence. And depending upon the classification of it, you were limited what you could do. Mm-hmm. However, if you had an intercepted conversation of President Putin talking to Donald Trump, you wouldn't have to say we believe. You wouldn't have to say we assume. You wouldn't have to say we assess. You say we know that on September 15th at 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Donald Trump was in conversations with Vladimir Putin. How do we know that? Because we've got it in the intercept. It's recorded. And the fact that, what Bill's pointing out here is that if NSA had actually grabbed the packets from the emails that were taken from the DNC and had traced those packets over all of the networks that it is tied into, they wouldn't have to say we have moderate confidence, because either you know or you're just guessing. And what they're doing, they're guessing.
Well, and we're referring, of course, to the January 7th intelligence community report under the signature of James Clapper, who is a proven perjurer before Congress. And that document was so loaded with weasel words, and it was appended with this bizarre 5 or 6 page attack on the Russian television network RT. And it exaggerated the reach of that media platform. It used stale data to attack Abby Martin for running an episode where she questioned the integrity of American elections. And somehow that is later construed to be doing the bidding of Moscow. These are consistent with the messages of the Russians. And so that whole thing is so, in my view, cartoonish. It is amazing how the corporate media has used that for the foundation of this entire concocted Russiagate narrative.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as in fact, let's go on to remember that NASA is the biggest conspirator collaborator with the Russians of all, because about every other month we're sending up astronauts to the space station on Russian vehicles. If the Russians weren't acting as our Uber driver or Lyft driver, we wouldn't get there.
Bill, you want to add anything here?
Yeah, that's a sad statement, because it basically says we've lost the ability to even build a Saturn V to go to the moon, you know?
Yeah.
It's really sad that we've allowed this to get to this state.
And so let me offer one other interesting article that has surfaced. Jim Bamford is a man I've been talking with for many years. He wrote 3 books that irritated successive NSA leaders, and he has great instincts, I think, as a reporter. And he wrote a lengthy piece recently published at the New Republic, and I'm scheduled to interview him about it in a couple of days. But he's just blown completely the fantasy that was built around this woman, Maria Butina. And because she was a pro-gun rights Russian who aligned with the NRA, once she was a suspect of Mueller's, and then, of course, dramatically seized to prevent her from seeking asylum and running back to Russia, this whole story just took on layers and layers of speculation. And Bamford has shown that almost none of that is true. And so this is an example of the kind of theater that Bob Mueller is producing.
Yes. Yeah, it is. Well, this anti-Russia hysteria, we saw it first emerge, really, at least a documented emergence, in a conversation, an email exchange between Brent Budowski and John Podesta in December of 2015, in which Budowski was making the case that they needed to paint Trump as a stooge of Putin. Yep. So they were already talking about this as a campaign strategy as early as December of 2015.
That's right.
When you go back into the early stages of 2015, what Donald Trump was saying about NATO, what he was saying about Syria, which in my view absolutely needed to be said, had to be said, should have been said, those were seen as a threat to both British interests and a lot of military establishment in this country. And so it was at that point that the Brits started their collection campaign against Trump, because they were worried that the positions he was taking, you know, that couldn't possibly be his own, even though they were. And they were looking desperately to try to link him to being manipulated by the Russians, and completely failed in that, because if such intelligence existed and if there was actual proof of that, maybe that thing would have been leaked in a heartbeat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Can I just add something here to that?
Because, please, Bill.
When it came to the saying they started spying on him, what they were really doing was going into the NSA database and pulling data about him.
Yes.
All that data was stored. It was scooped up in mass collection of information and stored in places like Utah, you know, that million-square-foot storage facility there.
Bluffdale.
And Fort Meade and San Antonio, a number of places around the country. And so all it took was them to go into that and look at it. And they've got direct access, and it's through the program called IC Reach. If you Google that, anybody listening, just go Google that, and you'll see that all the Five Eyes have access directly into the NSA database. And do you ever hear anybody talking about oversight of that? No, you don't.
Mm-hmm. Well,
because there isn't any.
Well, and the other in tandem with that is the fact that there were over 200 names of people affiliated with the Trump campaign unmasked means that what Bill's saying is those names were in that information and had been issued as intelligence reports. That's the only way those names would get out there, because if they appear in an intelligence report that's classified, in this case most likely top secret, then that gives the people of working that were part of the Obama administration a pretext for requesting, well, who is this? And, I mean, it's such a, the massive number of names in itself should be telling about how extensive and vast this effort was against the Trump campaign.
And they got a warrant against one of the fellows in the working in the Trump campaign. And what that meant was, according to the Obama, you know, when it was 2014, January 2014, he said, I'm only going to allow them to go out 2 degrees. And NSA was really happy about that. And I'll tell you why. Because having somebody in the Trump campaign, if they ever called the Republican National Committee or anybody else in a, you know, an organizational structure of the Republican Party, that gave them looking the ability to look beyond that to everybody who contacted that group. So it's like, and here's why NSA was quite happy with that. So if, for example, any terrorist anywhere in the world uses Google, well, Google, a second hop out of Google goes to 1.5 billion people roughly every day. So within a very few days, you have everybody on the planet. So that gave them license to do that. By getting that warrant with against that justified them looking at everybody in the Republican National Committee, everybody in the Trump campaign, all of them.
You're referring to Carter Page, right?
Yes.
Yeah. He first was picked up in 2014, you're correct. And I had not previously heard about the 2 degrees latitude that was assigned to his case.
Yeah, that was that's the general rule for NSA.
I see.
In terms of their ability to use that. That was justified by the president January 2014. He passed that. He was trying to modify how NSA did things. That's what he wanted everybody to believe.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
But what really was going on was he was setting the base for justification for them to look at everybody on the planet.
So I made a list before we sat down to talk today, and I entitled it Leads That Mueller Hasn't Pursued. And at the top of the list is Bill Binney's theorem. Bill, as of the 19th of February, 2019, have you had any contact with the special counsel, and has anyone related to him expressed interest in the evidence that you have discovered?
No, nor have any of the committees, House, Senate, Judicial, Intelligence, none of them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And we know that Julian Assange has not been contacted even to challenge the claims that he has made about, dismissing Russia as the source of the information. As recently as 3 weeks ago, I was on a video link with Ambassador Craig Murray, and he said at that time that he still is awaiting any contact from the special counsel. In our discussion, we've already talked about Seth Rich and, by implication, other DNC insiders. And Imran Awan finished up my list here, and we discussed him. But there's one more source that I want to air out, and I want to make it clear that I have an argument and not quite a case. And that is that once the Vault 7 tools were stolen or acquired, and this murky group Shadow Brokers said that they would do an online auction, we have to assume that any foreign intelligence agency worth its salt had acquired Vault 7. And so it occurs to me that Mossad has the means, the motive, and the opportunity to create the Russiagate cover story. And if you'll hear me out for a moment, Israel has a history of spying on its ally, the United States, Jonathan Pollard in 1987, Larry Franklin in 2006. Benjamin Netanyahu was running an overt campaign in support of Trump and against Hillary Clinton in 2016. He came and spoke to a joint session of Congress. Somebody related to Israel had been intercepting phone calls of members of Congress during the run-up to the vote to approve the Iran nuclear agreement. And we have a very well-funded and sophisticated network that is called the Israel Lobby. And I don't know if you've seen the suppressed Al Jazeera documentary called The Lobby USA, but using a hidden camera reporter, they expose quite a bit in the words of the people who work for the Israel Lobby. And so it does occur to me that this was one of the myriad efforts that Israel used to try to derail the Iran deal, and once it became effective, to try to unravel it by supporting Trump over Clinton. Let me ask you first, Bill, what's your reaction?
I would not be surprised at all, simply because of the access and the capabilities that they have and the things that they've been doing. I mean, they are, I'm quite sure, a part of the bulk acquisition of the information of the world by, you know, them and the Five Eyes and about nine other countries in Europe and Asia. So that wouldn't surprise me at all. I mean, I think that's quite likely.
And Larry, do you have a comment?
Well, I would just simply note that we have, you know, never lived in a time, at least since 1920, where foreign governments have been running intelligence operations inside the United States, a variety of foreign governments. And, I mean, Israel has already on the record doing a variety of things, going like Jonathan Pollack is an example, spying on behalf of Israel. And, you know, that's entirely appropriate from Israel's standpoint. It's not appropriate from our standpoint. The thing I look at as I see this entire Russiagate unfold is from Israel's standpoint, I think having Trump in office would be something they'd want because he has been the most pro-Israeli or pro-Netanyahuite we've ever had in the American presidency by virtue of moving the U.S. Embassy to Jerusalem, etc.
And to quickly breach the Iran agreement unilaterally.
Right. But at the same time, what I see the effort to undermine Trump as originating from other sources, I think particularly the Ukraine, they have been some potential unnamed actors in this, and there are a lot of fingerprints leading to them. I guess the point is to recognize we're living in an active environment where there are foreign intelligence operations of a whole host going on, and what Russia is alleged to have done is, A, nothing new. And if we're not prepared to deal with this kind of thing across the board, we're living like an ostrich with our head in the sand.
And Larry, I want to know if you happen to have seen the New Yorker mega story that was released about a week ago under the byline of Ronan Farrow and Adam Entus, which describes these private Israel-based intelligence firms that employ people almost exclusively who used to work for Mossad. And this is so amazing because in 2016, this Israeli-based company, Psi Group, took a contract to get involved in an election in Little Tulare, California. Mm-hmm. Now, this is at the, in the Central Valley. It's a little farm town. And the election that they got involved with and used some very high-tech techniques that are similar to what the Russians are accused of, was a hospital board election with a total of like 1,500 votes altogether. And they used the same kind of operations, manipulating Facebook. They tried to create the false impression that the candidate they were attacking had taken a bribe, and they set up the whole photo that was used to propel that. They used fake websites, Tulare Truth and Tulare Leaks. And so this suggests to me that there are a lot of freelance operators who have at least past connections to Israeli intelligence who are marketing their services in the U.S. And Black Cube was a similar company that was hired by Harvey Weinstein to try to silence the women who were accusing him.
Yeah, well, I think generally what you'll find that today, the ones who will be most innovative and being able to take the biggest risk and do sometimes the most unwise activities will be those in the private sector that do have prior intelligence experience, because they are generally free of the bureaucracy and they don't have to always get permission or have to worry about somebody signing off on something and then running the risk of being held accountable down the line when it comes time for promotion. You know, that terrifies a bureaucrat. And so they will shy away from that. But I spend a lot of time working in the field of money laundering investigations. The criminal organizations and networks are so far ahead of what the U.S. government is doing. The U.S. government really doesn't have a clue. They're always playing catch-up, and they're catching, you know, it's like following the elephants 2 days after they've gone through on a parade. They're picking up the elephant droppings here and there, but they're not doing nothing to change the course the elephants are traveling.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, this Al Jazeera documentary, The Lobby USA, shows the incredible networks that have been set up. And near me at the University of California, Davis, in 2014-15, they ran an operation that appeared to be student-driven, but the students acknowledged that they received support from allies of AIPAC, and Al Jazeera traces some of the efforts back directly to Israel's Office of Strategic Affairs. And so this suggests to me that there is a long-running influence campaign in the United States run in the interests of the state of Israel. And I find this really chilling.
Well, but, you know, I would accuse the Israeli politicians and intelligence leaders of being incompetent if they weren't doing that. I mean, that is, you know, I'm a firm believer that every country ought to do what is in that country's own interest, and that if they're not acting in accordance with that, they're, you know, they're insane or incompetent. So I just to recognize that that's the we're playing in an active field. I believe every country, almost every major company has intelligence organizations of variety, and they're out there pursuing activities designed, you hope, to serve the interests of that country. And I would love somebody to do a comparison of Israel's activity in the United States by Russia's, because I think you're right, Peter. It would show Israel's been far more active, spent far more money, and been far more effective in many aspects. I mean, if you just look at the number of Democrats and Republicans that go genuflect at the AIPAC conference every year, it's remarkable.
Well, and the way they closed ranks to denounce a couple of tweets that suggested that Israeli groups have a lot of money and that's one of the reasons they have a hold over both parties in Congress.
Yeah, it's a shame you can't have just an honest, objective discussion about this without being accused of being an anti-Semite.
Yeah.
I mean, I've been a lifelong supporter of the Holocaust Museum, but simply by raising this as a, you know, legitimate issue to look at, I can rapidly be accused of, you know, some Nazi sympathizer that wants to reopen the gas ovens at Auschwitz.
Yeah, that is part of their strategy, and it is quite effective, as we have seen. Bill?
Well, I mean, that's pretty much the strategy they're using with Russiagate, too. I mean, there's not really much difference. It's, if you aren't believing what they're saying, you know, you are obviously, not in favor of the basically protecting the United States from these enemies that are obviously attacking us, you know?
Well, and it's this manufactured consensus coupled to a kind of imposed orthodoxy. And
yep.
If you're skeptical even of parts of it, I have been hearing how I'm a tool of Russia and all those kinds of smears.
No, you're right. It's shocking to me that people who, former intelligence officers, former colleagues, who genuinely have bought into some of this nonsense.
Yeah.
And it doesn't even stand up to reason or logic.
Yeah.
If I can add a little bit of humor here, I was working on a theorem to be able to assess some of this stuff. And I basically boiled down to, if a politician is talking to you, 80% of what he's saying is probably a lie. If a bureaucrat is talking to you, 90% of it's probably a lie. So you can use that as a fundamental way of assessing what people are telling you. In other words, verify everything because you can't trust anybody in government.
And that's the Bill Binney Theorem 2.9.
Yeah, right. There's lots of proof of that, too, by the way.
Well, Bill's a wise man in that regard.
Let me ask if either of you has a final comment. First, Bill Binney?
No, I just think that I would like to emphasize that people really need to start thinking about what they're really doing. And it's the point really is you're losing structured thought. You know, you're losing the critical thinking that it takes to be a success in this world. And driving it on emotion is like, that's what happened in the Tonkin Gulf affair. That's what happened with weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You know, that's what's happened in Libya and all over the world. And people are getting killed and hurt and maimed. And this is because people don't challenge things. We have to open up now and say, hey, we've got to think of anything, take any other aspect in and think about it. And not just consider and blindly accept the one the version coming down from government.
Well, and Bill, the one in the pipeline is Venezuela, as we see the Democrats unquestioning in the way Trump has recognized this self-appointed rump leader, we're now just basically declaring that it's over for Maduro, and we'll do whatever it takes to enforce that. And it is the same exact ploy, in my view.
Yeah, that's very similar, and the whole idea is we need to challenge everything and look at everything and question everything. So, and we're not doing that yet.
All right, Larry C. Johnson.
Yeah, I guess I would just wish, and I'm probably naive in this desire, that we would learn to focus on simple facts, and notice the facts in this case with respect to the DNC emails. FBI has not conducted a forensic examination. The intelligence assets have not been tasked to provide the actual proof that would substantiate the theory that they've been advancing. And all of this is being used as a pretext to take out a democratically elected president. And it is the manipulation of the system is nothing new. And as Bill was pointing out, and it goes back to, we saw Dan Ellsberg get vilified in much the same way when he exposed the lies that were connected with the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've had, and he goes back, I think, to Eisenhower's warning about the military-industrial complex. I'm not so much a conspiracy theorist, but the weight of these bureaucracies and institutions carries such weight that the inertia of it just pushes it forward. And we're seeing it erupt in a variety of ways. We saw it with the push to go to war in Iraq in 2003 over a pretext, and no accountability.
And Larry, I'll only separate myself from one part of what you said there. I don't consider Trump's election to be a Democratic effort. The voter suppression schemes that we're running and many other factors lead me to say that Nicolas Maduro has a more credible claim to a legitimate election than the Trump campaign did from 2016.
Well, right, but we've seen this throughout our history, going back to the Kennedy Nixon elections as an example.
Well, I do accept that he was installed as president and he serves. Okay.
Yeah, and it's just that we fail to come to grips with how easily the system has been manipulated, and it is the manipulation I'm seeing on a level that I have never. I'm 64 years old now. I've never seen anything like this in my lifespan, and it is far worse than anything I saw working with the CIA. I was right in the middle of all the Iran-Contra stuff back in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And never saw anything like this.
Well, gentlemen, thank you for spending time with us today to air this out, and I will link to your report in the show file for this podcast so our listeners can easily click and read it. Larry C. Johnson, Bill Binney, great talking with you today.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Peter.
Thanks for listening to this in-depth interview with Bill Binney and Larry C. Johnson. Send your comments to Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until